Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What treasures can be found in the Dallas Museum of Art's permanent collection of works from Asia, and how has the DMA built and refined its acquisition strategy over time? Having greatly expanded its Asian art collection over the past two decades, the DMA has just published a photo-illustrated catalog of what it owns. The book serves as not only a record of the museum's offerings, but also a fascinating source of context for the works themselves. Anne Bromberg is here to talk about it. She is Cecil and Ida Green Curator of Ancient and Asian Art at the Dallas Museum of Art and author of the new catalog, which is called The Arts of India, Southeast Asia, Asia, and the Himalayas. Anne, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So why has the collection taken off since the mid-90s in particular?
That is something I think about a great deal, and I actually participated in the shift. For most of its history, the Dallas Museum of Art in Asian art mainly collected Japanese and secondarily Chinese art. We had some important pieces of Indian art as far back as the 1960s. I'm old enough to remember this exhibit, a truly groundbreaking exhibit at the Dallas Museum of Art in its old building in Fair Park was The Arts of Man, the first big international show of art from all over the world, including a lot of non-Western art, pre-Columbian, African, Asian, and so forth. And that really brought to the eyes of collectors, museum people, just people who liked art in Dallas, this fascinating array of artworks from everywhere. And several supporters of the museum bought some Indian artworks from that show, which, of course, are still in the collection, including a major relief of the Hindu god Vishnu. So that started us off, but for the next few decades, there was some collecting, but not a great deal. In the late 1980s, Dr. Emily Sano was the deputy director of the Dallas Museum of Art. And while she was a Japanese scholar, she got interested in a collector who was born in Dallas, David Owsley, though he has lived much of his life in New York and still lives there. She looked at his collection in New York and was so impressed with it that she said that we would do a show, an exhibit of his collection, which included European as well as Asian and other artworks. David has very diverse interests. In any event, not too long after we made this decision and talked to David Owsley, Emily Sano became the director of the Asian Museum in San Francisco, and basically I inherited David's exhibit, and we set it up, and it occurred in the early 1990s. Everybody loved it. It was the beginning of an extraordinarily rich, productive relationship with David Owsley, who is really working together with the museum, has really expanded our Indian, Himalayan, Southeast Asian collection enormously. So we now have a very important collection signified by the publication. Mm-hmm. You never know in a museum what's going to happen.
Right? So how does David Owsley's vision and his philosophy about collecting influence the things that the museum acquires on its own?
Well, David is a very experienced person. He has a background in art history. He was a museum curator, actually, and has worked with several museums, including the Museum of Fine Arts Boston, the Victoria and Albert in London, and for a number of years was curator at the Carnegie Mellon Museum in Pittsburgh. And he thinks the way a curator thinks, let's put it that way. He also thinks the way a collector thinks. Mm-hmm. Ooh, I want it. All collectors feel that way. But he really does understand the issues involved in collecting for a museum, and that's important because in a lot of cases, the museum has fundamentally joined what funds we have for acquisitions with David Owsley's funds in order to get a piece that probably neither he nor we would get independently. But he's really knowledgeable about Asian art and has excellent taste, honed by a lifetime in collecting and curating and so on. So, I mean, that doesn't mean we always agree. We we may disagree, or, you know, periodically the museum gets a new director with a different take on where the museum should be going. But I would say that overall, the relationship between the museum's staff from the director down, including me and the other curators, has been very positive with David.
So let's talk about, we'll start with the Indian art in the collection. What sorts of ancient motifs have lasted for millennia unchanged, and why haven't they changed, maybe to the same extent that other art traditions would have changed particular motifs?
Well, I'm not sure about that you could strictly say unchanging. The motif that seems to me to have a very long life is...
Maybe enduring is a better word.
Yeah. Well, the obvious answer to that is because of the importance of the motifs, say, to the Hindu religion, or indeed for Buddhist works to the Buddhist religion. But I do think that there are frequently changes in artistic style or interpretation based on who the patrons of the artworks were at a particular period, what they were being used for, and so on. The one that seems to me to have had the longest life and is visible in a number of different parts of our collection is the sensuous female figure. This one of them is entitled A Divine Entertainer, and then there's a figure that's probably a human dancing girl. But that idea of the sensuous, scantily dressed female figure that's in motion frequently, like the dancer, and is almost always shown in a curved contrapposto pose, and very attractive and alluring and so on. It occurs in many different contexts and indeed passed from Hindu art to Buddhist art. We have examples of that too. So that for a motif that we have early examples of that goes back to the 9th or 10th centuries, the museum has this fabulous silver shrine from the early 19th mm-hmm. century, which has got all kinds of enchanting things, including courtiers on elephants, which are real cute. But it has an array of heavenly dancing girls at the top of this large domed silver shrine.
How much can be known about the way that artists, particularly those working 1,000 years ago or more, were trained and sort of developed their own skills?
That is a very good question, and there really isn't an answer to it. Many of these craft people were anonymous, perhaps most of them, at least up, say, to the 16th, 17th century. And even then, many of them were anonymous. They were what was remembered in inscriptions with who the patrons were, the king, the noble people, whoever, the queen in case of Chola bronzes in South India. The patrons are seen as responsible for the artworks. And the artist just does it. You know, you pay part of paying to have the work made is you pay the craftsperson who makes it. And this is not just true of India. It's true all over the world. Most of these, what we call artists in the Western eye, were basically craft people, often very well off, very cultivated, extremely knowledgeable craft people, but craftspeople. It's interesting that only recently the Metropolitan Museum in New York just did a show on this, that scholars only quite recently have identified the particular miniature painters who made the wonderful manuscript illustrations and miniature paintings of the early Mughal period. And the Metropolitan devoted a show to who were these people and what do we know about them? What can you say about how they were trained and what they did? Otherwise, you're talking about workshops attached to a temple, for instance, or to a royal court or something like that.
So I guess a temple or a royal court or a patron would just be really lucky to find someone who was incredibly skilled, would they?
No, I think it works the other way around. I think that a civilization where constantly anybody who can afford it is collecting art as offerings to the gods, mm-hmm. as offerings to temples, that's true of kings and queens. I mean, basically, the great Chola bronzes in South India were gifts of kings and queens to temples as a sign of their devotion to the Hindu deities. You might be interested in this. It struck both my husband and I really powerfully. In a trip just a few years ago to South India, a temple had had its marvelous Halabid era sculptures restored. They were restored by a well-to-do businessman who said in the inscription in English outside the temple that the sculptures had been restored as a religious offering to try to make up for the injustice done to the Harijans, the outcasts, which we thought was just amazing. But actually, that's just the modern twist on a very long tradition of people. Frankly, I would say in, say, medieval Christian Europe, donations of art and paintings and sculptures and so on, or even building whole cathedrals by royalty of the upper class was the same kind of thing. It was essentially a Christian offering. And in India, it's a Hindu offering, or in some cases, a Buddhist offering.
So is it only a relatively recent thing, Anne, that people would purchase this art and then put it in their homes or in their place of business as opposed to...
Oddly enough, it isn't, but it's the same thing. They do buy them for their homes frequently so that they can have images of the gods they worship, particularly, you know, if they're devotees of Shiva. To have works representing Shiva or Shiva and his wife Parvati or something like that around. Another story on that line that has often appealed to me is that the first gallery we set up to show David Owsley's collection as it was some 15 years ago at the museum, we had Pratapaditya Pal, America's leading scholar in Indian art, give a talk. And he gave a very interesting talk. And in the question and answer session after that, someone asked, well, you know, doesn't removing religious works from India, don't the priests or the temples object to that? And Dr. Pal said, oh, no. He said, I'm a Hindu, and everyone I know in India, if they want a religious work for themselves, wants a brand new, recently made, untouched work of art rather than an old crumbling piece, which is certainly true. And Indian artists, craftspeople, whatever you want to call them, are today making bronze sculptures, stone sculptures, paintings, you name it, in exactly the same traditional way they were made over 1,000 years ago. My husband and I actually collect these pieces. There are government craft stores that sell absolutely knockout, say, over life-size bronze sculptures of Hindu gods and goddesses that were made today, basically.
And there's not the sort of stigma of reproduction that we might see in other art traditions.
No, because it's a living religion and a living civilization. That's what makes India so exciting. It isn't past. It's right now. We are Hindu. We worship Vishnu or Shiv or Durga or whoever. And, you know, we want the latest, most beautiful things to honor our gods.
We're speaking this hour with Anne Bromberg. She's Cecil and Ida Green Curator of Ancient and Asian Art at the Dallas Museum of Art and author of the brand new catalog, The Arts of India, Southeast Asia, and the Himalayas. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. SMU.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ann Bromberg. She's Cecil and Ida Green, curator of ancient and Asian art at the Dallas Museum of Art and author of the new catalog, The Arts of India, Southeast Asia, and the Himalayas. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Anne, how do you take decades of scholarship by yourself and other people, millennia of art, and put them into a, albeit a large and beautiful, but compact volume, essentially? I mean, what does it take to sort of decide what you want the catalog to cover and how you will communicate all that information and what goes into it?
It takes a lot of chutzpah. There were several moments when I thought this enterprise is just too big.
Yeah.
But I think in part the answer to that is that I was trained at Harvard in anthropology. First thing, my BA is in anthropology from the Peabody Museum at Harvard, where you were trained to think about what people have in common around the world, how cultures differ, to essentially take a global view of the development of human civilization. And that is a really useful way to think about art and religion in any part of the world, what it means to people, you know, how it holds their societies together, and so forth. I didn't get into formal art history and archaeology till graduate school. My MA and PhD from Harvard are in classical art and archaeology. But I wouldn't take anything for having spent the first 4 years of college being trained in anthropology. It just makes you think in a different way than conventional art history makes you think about art.
What do you mean?
Well, you see art as an expression of an individual culture or peoples, whether it's tribal people in New Guinea or the ancient Greeks or whoever, that art is a way that people use to express the values of their society, their religions, their hopes, their dreams, that it's intimately tied into the way people act and interact with each other and their beliefs and, you know, how they run their lives. Mm-hmm. And you need to understand that to understand what art is doing. That's why it seems to me that although the areas covered in the book are huge, the history is time span is immense. The earliest work in the book is 2500 BC. So you're talking about over four millennia of art and history. But wide and diverse as they are, you can make an effort to try to explain, for instance, what in terms of Hindu culture under the Chola dynasty in South India, our great Shiva Nataraja figure meant mm-hmm. to the people. But then what does it say to us now? Why is the god Shiva shown in the particular form he's shown in? But you could ask that about anything in the book. And hopefully the book makes it a little clearer, both the history and the anthropology, if you like, of these rich pieces.
How did you decide on the co-authors and the other people who would write essays and explanations for the catalog?
Before telling you how I decided on them or we decided on them, I'd like just to thank them. if there was a considerable amount of chutzpah on my part in this overarching creation of this volume, the individual scholars that worked with me and with the museum certainly contributed a great deal. We had actually had various visiting scholars look at the collection and produce their ideas before we went to work on the book proper. I would particularly like to thank John Huntington and Professor Janice Lioshko from the University of Texas at Austin. Janice did a lot of early research on the pieces. And we had other scholars, too, at that early stage. But when we decided to do the book, we felt we needed people who were experts in these very far-flung fields. Mm-hmm. And the people that agreed to help us were Frederick Asher from the University of Minnesota, who's a professor there, his wife Catherine Asher, who is a noted scholar of Islamic art and of Mughal period India, Nancy Tingley, who is an independent scholar in this Asian, once associated with the Asian Museum in San Francisco. She's still working in San Francisco, who has served as a curator for many important Asian shows, but specializes in Southeast Asian art. She did worked on that chapter. And Robert Warren Clark, who is in the Tibetan program at Stanford University. They brought an in-depth expertise for each of the areas, major areas covered in the publication that was invaluable. But we all exchanged ideas. You know, we traded the text for the entries and everybody made some changes. And I passed around all the historical cultural narratives I wrote. It was just a very productive and happy experience. And I think has gone to make the book as rich as it is, considering the amount of territory that it covers.
It is vast. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Mughal period. This is essentially characterized by an introduction of Hindu and Muslim sort of cultural elements to the same people. Is that accurate?
Well, I think you first have to consider the fact that really, as far back as the 8th century, there were Islamic warriors and rulers invading North India, and the establishment of various kingdoms in northern India ruled by Muslim rulers, notably the Sultanate of Delhi, which lasted for a long time. But in the early 16th century, Babur, who was a descendant of Tamerlanes, an Islamic Mongol, came to India, conquered northern India, and established the Mughal Empire, which ruled originally much of northern India and came to include the Deccan and central India to the and parts of the south too. The Mughal Empire never conquered far southern India, which remained Hindu, but basically they were dominant over much of northern and central India.
For like 3.5 centuries.
Yes, exactly, till the mid-19th century. And the court art that Babur and his successors established at Delhi, the capital of their empire, had a huge influence on the development of Indian art. Even independent principalities, like the Rajput principalities, where the Rajput princes were Hindus, even there, the style of the art from the 16th century on was heavily influenced by Mughal court art. Certainly the development of painting in India, particularly David Ousley has given us an important collection of Indian miniature paintings that he has built up. The development in painting in India, which started out as painting for the local religious traditions, Jain or Hindu, whatever, but under the Mughal Empire took on many of the aspects and the styles of Mughal court painting, which in the long run was influenced from Persia. So you do have a very complex mix that lasted for a long time. And it's often called Indo-Muslim art because the Mughals' rulers may have been Muslim, but the Muslims settled in India were attracted by and influenced by Hindu art, too. And you get this mixture of styles with a lot of influences going in all directions. And it happens that we have, from the 16th to the 19th century, fascinating pieces, some of which are purely Hindu, but they show this Indo-Muslim mix, like this pair of architectural brackets, which has motifs, warriors on horseback and so on, that could be Mughal or Muslim or Hindu or indeed Jain or whatever. And the shrine I mentioned, the early 19th century Silver Overwood Shrine, which was designed for a holy figure, either Jain or sculpture about that big, that would be either Jain or Hindu, that shrine is certainly a very good example of the combination of Mughal Muslim and Hindu art.
Do you ever find a piece, Anne, that depicts a well-known god, but there's something different about it from the typical depictions, and you have to sort of wonder why an artist chose to put this figure in a different pose or have them with a different, object or something?
Not frequently. Iconography does change, but it tends to change, more from period to period. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, what comes to mind immediately is a piece that we have just acquired so recently that it is not even on view yet. Indeed, it hasn't even been formally presented to the Committee on Collections. It's a very interesting piece, though, that does more or less bear out what you're saying. It's of the god Vishnu and his wife Lakshmi. And we have two very important images of Vishnu from earlier periods that represent traditional ways of showing Vishnu. Vishnu, the preserver of the Hindu Trinity, sort of supporting the universe, standing upright, surrounded by his heavenly attendants, and very formal, beneficent figure. That's a standard way to present Vishnu. And alternatively, since Vishnu is thought by his followers to have had at least 10 incarnations or avatars, we have this truly gorgeous, very dramatic, large sculpture of Vishnu in his boar-headed form as Varaha, preserving the earth goddess. It's a great work for today if you think about global warming, and Vishnu saving the earth goddess from a demon. But anyway, that, however, is again a way of showing Vishnu in his boar-headed form that goes back centuries from the time our sculpture was made. There's a prominent one in, early on in the Udayagiri caves in central India. So that's what you'd expect. Our figure, our previous sculpture of Lakshmi, this exquisite little bronze, you know, she's this gorgeous, sexy female that's the bringer of prosperity and so on. But the new piece is something quite different and very interesting. Can't wait to get it on display. It's Vishnu and Lakshmi in a sort of marital embrace, affectionately holding each other and touching each other. They're riding on Vishnu's mount, the Garuda, usually shown as a bird, in this case as a sort of winged man or attendant who's carrying it. But it's so intimate and affectionate. It's very, almost we would say, romantic. And it comes from a period where we have another work of the god Shiva and his wife Parvati, which is very similar, from the area around Khajuraho in north-central India, where Khajuraho, of course, is best known for its erotic sculptures. But truly what marks the art around the Khajuraho area from the Chandela period is this sense of human affection between god and goddess or whoever. It's very touching. And the new Vishnu Lakshmi sculpture is very touching, and anybody would identify with it and think, oh, boy and girlfriend sort of thing.
Is that human touch maybe something that artists would have avoided because these are gods and you want to make
Well, I think it's more that earlier periods, the gods were shown in very defined, you know, religiously defined iconographic ways, formal ways. But that over the course of time, and particularly with the course of enthusiastic development of a feeling that human passions led to enlightenment, that is the real rationale for the erotic sculptures at the temples at Khajuraho, that human sexuality can be seen as a way to become one with the divine and abolish duality, to become one sort of visionary thing. And that's why I think these romantic god and goddess embracing sculptures were so popular.
So for works that initially would have been displayed in a temple or a shrine or some sort of religious setting, when you take them out of that initial location and put them in a museum setting, I mean, are they enhanced by the fact that they're sort of isolated, or is there something that you're fighting against losing with regard to context?
Well, they look good in the museum, and people can relate to them more intimately, having spent my life wandering around a lot of very large carved Hindu temples, which is roughly like circumambulating a very large mountain. Well, they are. They're in mountain form, pyramidal form. But it's an issue that occurs in other areas, too, in African art, in Indonesian art. To some degree, I think in Japanese art, where we have an important kind of wood sculpture, the Buddhist sculpture that would have been shown inside a Japanese temple, and it would just look totally different there than the way it looks in a museum.
Yeah.
So it's a trade-off. I mean, museums exist so that people can see art and relate to art. They're better lit. You know, people can interact with them in a way that you couldn't really in a temple. But you are missing the overwhelming experience of patiently walking around a Hindu temple or a Buddhist temple, a mountain temple like Borobudur in Java, which my husband and I have just been back to. And to the Hindu or the Buddhist, walking around looking at the artworks is a religious experience. You're learning something. In fact, our last trip to Khajuraho, looking at one of the main temples with lots of erotic sculpture, there was this young girl and her brother and her groom-to-be, and they stopped and chatted with us, and they explained that the brother was taking the girl and the young man around before they were married so they would learn what marriage should be about, which is not something that we would think about.
I love that idea.
It's wonderful. And, you know, it's great stuff. It's great art, but it's also humanly very exciting and moving.
Which is interesting because you don't necessarily think about people in Western cultures. You know, there's still statuary and, you know, Catholic churches and things like that.
Right.
But people don't necessarily go to them looking for a lesson, a life lesson.
No, that's true. And again, oddly enough, one of the things that brought home to me how a different tradition can influence how you experience Christianity was in Santa Fe, where there's a church in Santa Fe that has a lot of what I guess you would call folk art of Christian themes and figures. And it's partly obviously influenced by the Spanish who ruled New Mexico for a long time. But there's also a good deal of the Pueblo Indian background to it, too. And the people, you could look at the people who were there, you know, for a service or just looking at the things. And they responded pretty much the way the young people at Khajuraho did to the Hindu temple. You know, it was theirs. It belonged to them. They felt it. You know,
yeah.
It wasn't just some abstract idea or something you learned in Sunday school or something like that.
My guest is Anne Bromberg. She's Cecil and Ida Green Curator of Ancient and Asian Art at the Dallas Museum of Art and author of the new book, The Arts of India, Southeast Asia, and the Himalayas. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the DMA's Anne Bromberg about her new book, The Arts of India, Southeast Asia, and the Himalayas. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. And what do visual representations of Buddhist ideas and tradition have in common with Hindu ideas, and where are they distinct?
The examples of Buddhist art we have in our collection, which are essentially from the Gandharan period in the first few centuries AD and the Gandharan Empire centered on what is now Pakistan and Afghanistan, that's a very important area, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Then our Tibetan collections, which are really fine and have some just dazzling pieces, but that both of these areas and types of art actually reflect a strong influence from Hindu gods and Hindu art forms. To take the Gandharan one first, the Gandharan Empire more or less was a direct result of Silk Road traffic. And if you have not been to the Dallas Museum of Art recently, I installed last year a Silk Road exhibit, which pulls works in the museum's collections that range all the way from ancient Greece and Rome through the Near East to Central Asia, China and Japan, and south to India.
So it's a trade route, essentially.
Yeah, mm-hmm. a trade route. And the Gandharan Empire basically was built up around a trade route. Trade routes that developed in part in the wake of Alexander the Great's, the Greek king's, conquests in Central Asia. Mm-hmm. And he made it as far as North India. But the Gandharan Empire was Buddhist, but in addition to that, the Gandharan period in the first few centuries AD was more or less the original place that the idea of the Bodhisattva originated. In addition to following the teachings of the historical Buddha Shakyamuni, who lived in the 6th and 5th centuries BC, by the time of the Gandharan Empire, a lot of Buddhists believed in the idea of the Bodhisattva. The nearest equivalent to that in the West, I guess, would be Christian saints. But a Bodhisattva is a person who has achieved enlightenment, moksha, but has chosen to continue to work with people and help people, other people.
For their benefit.
For their mm-hmm. benefit. So they're definitely good guys. And the great classic Bodhisattvas, Maitreya, Avalokiteshvara, Padmapani, and so on, pretty much began to develop during the Gandharan period. And we have a number of very fine Gandharan pieces, one of which was a gift from a donor to the museum as far back as the 1970s, but on the other hand, a relatively recent new acquisition is one of the finest Gandharan pieces in the whole collection and really expresses the idea of the Bodhisattva. It's called a thinking Buddha, and it's the Bodhisattva who realized in the world of eternity that he was going to be reincarnated as the historical Buddha, the founder of Buddhism. And he's sitting there thinking, what is it going to be like to be the Buddha, to create a new vision of the world, a new set of precepts to live by, ways to understand the meaning of the universe, and so on. And the figure, like most bodhisattvas, is shown as a very royal figure in lavish clothes, a king indeed, with a crown, and in very Persian style. The influence of Persian art on India at various periods is quite marked. And the lion throne that the bodhisattva sits on is essentially a Persian idea. But it's, again, really humanly very powerful and communicative, as the figure of a bodhisattva should be. From northern India, particularly from eastern northeast India under the Pala dynasty from the 8th to the 12th centuries AD, but also via the Gandharan Empire, its remnants, or North India, Buddhism passed from the place where it originated in northern India to the Himalayas, to Nepal and Tibet, where, of course, it is still a very strong influence. And interestingly to me, if you look at our Tibetan collection, which the just superbly modeled, bejeweled gilt bronze figures of various Buddhist holy figures in our Tibetan collection are certainly some of the finest and most exciting pieces. But they also show the influence of Hindu art and Hindu ideas. The god Shiva, for instance, in his wrathful form as Bhairava, the terrible god, there is this huge mask from the Himalayas, gilded mask of Shiva as Bhairava, the ferocious, the terrible one. Terrifying deities who look terrifying but are actually beneficent protectors of the Buddhist law, the Dharma, are really important in the Himalayan area. But the Bhairava mask is particularly fun for visitors when they learn that it was, actually still is, the same kind of mask used at festivals in Nepal, where there is a huge jug of beer behind the mask, and the worshiper can drink beer from the deity's mouth through a straw, more or less. That's very popular. But the figures are wonderful, and the idea of what's often nowadays called a demonic divine in Tibetan tantric art, where these figures with skulls and flames and look like monsters The protectress of the Dalai Lama in Lhasa is shown as this demonic-looking figure riding through a sea of blood, but she is basically a protective figure. The terrifying aspect of the artwork turns away evil and also gets people, monks, for instance, who live with these offerings. It helps monks to meditate on why am I afraid of dying and suffering? How can I pass beyond dying and suffering, which is the message that the Buddha preached? So there is a lot of transition, particularly from the cult of Shiva, but also these very sexy, scantily clad female figures occur in Tibetan Buddhist art, too, where you might not expect them, but if you understand the meaning in the original Indian context, you can see why they were taken over into Buddhism. The same thing with Shiva's son Ganesha, the elephant-headed god, who's one of the most popular deities in India today among Hindus because he brings prosperity and good fortune and promises that any enterprise you start will come to a good end. But that passed into Buddhism, and there are Buddhist images of Ganesha also. So there's a very close relationship. It's not like there's no barrier. If something seems to have a powerful spiritual meaning and the artwork is strong enough to convey it, then it moves from Hinduism to Buddhism with very little change. We have a huge tanka that shows a tantric Tibetan deity embracing his female and what is an pretty explicit sexual embrace, but what it means is that human love transcends duality to achieve enlightenment.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Shannon in Arlington. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon. This question to Anne. In 7th century is when the Arabs invaded Persia, and some of the Persians moved further into India. These are the followers of Zoroastrians. Did they bring any significant cultural and art influence in Indian art? For example, I see miniatures. Indian have miniatures and Persian have miniatures. And did the miniature painting come from Persia to India or vice versa? And do you have some on display?
Yeah, well, I think your question actually has two different answers. The people I assume you're talking about are the Parsis, who settled in western India and obviously had an important cultural influence on Indian civilization more generally. And there are, of course, still Parsis in India today. But on the miniature painting, I think that the movement from Persia was a little different. It was more that court painters from Persia went and worked for the Mughal emperors. The Emperor Humayun, who was an immediate descendant of Babur's, actually spent some time in exile in Persia. He loved Persian culture, and he brought back to India, when he came back, a real enthusiasm for Persian art. What I was trying to say earlier is that Indian miniature painting really shifted gears under the Mughal emperors. Even if it was painting done for Rajput princes, it still shows this Mughal courtly art style, which ultimately stemmed from Persia. And in answer to your question about are they on view? Yes. We, like all works on paper, we have to rotate them, but there are 5 or 6 of the miniature paintings up in the Indian galleries, and so you can see them.
I was interested to read that the jewelry that you have at the DMA from the Mughal period represented more than simply a way for people to ornament themselves. Can you talk a little bit about the symbolism?
Oh, absolutely. They were of great social significance. Actually, most of the things, the bejeweled weapon, the dagger with a jade horse head, the necklaces and so on, the arm bracelets, these were gifts that the Mughal rulers gave to people they favored as a sign that the person had taken a step up in the court hierarchy. So, yes, they had a great deal of ceremonial and political significance. The silver scepter, for instance, is a sign of power. And interestingly, a lot of the daggers, including the sort of two-handled dagger, dagger, the katar, which is very popular in India, are shown in the miniature paintings. Mm-hmm. The scepter, the katar, the other examples of jewelry, if you look carefully at our miniature paintings or reproductions of miniature paintings in books, you will see that the noble figures represent and almost always have this kind of jewelry. And it isn't just because it's pretty. Mm-hmm. It is pretty, yeah. but it's a very expensive sign of status and mm-hmm. rise in position.
And there are some pieces that are done in enamel, but the enamel work, all the colorful enamel work is on the inside, or a lot of it?
Yeah, I mean, there is inlaid enamel, cloisonné enamel, actually, which is a technique that was very popular in India. The cloisons are metal, often gold or silver, uprights on the surface that's being decorated, which are filled with molten enamel, which then hardens so that you have a raised pattern. That's really what cloisonné enamel is. Mm-hmm. Yes. There's a really interesting connection with miniature painting. Mughal period books, often the individual picture has a floral border around the outside of each scene. That's very common. And the same thing with the weapons. They have floral patterns that I think originally occurred because originally Muslim art did not represent the human figure, so that floral patterns are very common in Islamic art all over the world. But floral patterns became particularly popular in India.
Is there special, I mean, do you recommend that people who want to go and look at the Asian collection at the DMA, should they prepare in some way? Should they just go with an open mind and be ready to learn and have fun?
I think that they should go with an open mind, and this gives me an opportunity to credit my husband with something. I should have started out by crediting the museum's great photographer, Brad Flowers, who did the photographs of all the artworks at the museum. However, the rest of the illustrations in the book are based on my husband, Alan Bromberg's photographs taken over a lifetime traveling around India and Southeast Asia. A selection of Alan's pictures with just musical background of Buddhist and Hindu music, no narrative, continuously runs at the beginning of the Indian Gallery on the third level of the DMA. And there's a bench where you can sit down, and lots of people feel that one of the best introductions to the art is just sitting down and looking at this gorgeous montage of Indian people and places and temples and artworks and just soak it up. And I think you will respond to the art a lot better if you looked at even some of that video.
Do you always have a trip planned, the next place you're ready to go, whether for work or for pleasure?
Well, sometimes, yes. We just went last summer to Java, Bali, and Burma, and we haven't quite figured out where we go next. But I'm sure we'll think of somewhere.
I have to imagine your family photo albums must be astonishing.
Yes, right. And we're hoping to digitize Alan's lifetime output of photography and probably give it to some public institution.
Ann Bromberg is Cecil and Ida Green Curator of Ancient and Asian Art at the Dallas Museum of Art, and she's the author of the new catalog, The Arts of India, Southeast Asia, and the Himalayas. Ann, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think and send any comments, questions, or suggestions via email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.